Arcady, not the largest of the ferals, being leader more from force of personality than size, was able to lift off the ground easily with 100 men dangling, perhaps a few more.
"We can fit nearly 2,000 across all of them," Lawrence said,
the trial complete, and handed the slate to Roland and Dyer to make them do the sums over, to be sure he had the numbers correct. Much to their disgruntlement, they felt it unfair to be set back to schoolwork in so remarkable a situation.
"We cannot risk overloading them," Lawrence added. "They must be able to make their escape if we are caught at it in the middle."
"If we don't take care of that Fleur de Nuit, we will be," Granby said. "If we engaged him tonight?"
Lawrence shook his head, not in disagreement, but in doubt.
"They are taking precious good care he is not exposed. To get anywhere near, we would have to come in range of their artillery and get directly into their midst. I've not seen him stir out of the covert since we arrived. He only watches us from that ridge and keeps well back."
"They would hardly need the Fleur de Nuit to tell them we were doing something tomorrow, if we made a great point of singling him out tonight," Tharkey pointed out. "He had much better be dealt with just before we begin." No one disagreed, but puzzling out the means left them at sixes and sevens a while. They could settle on nothing better than staging a diversion, using the littler dragons to bombard the French front ranks. The glare would interfere with the Fleur de Nuit's vision, and in the meantime the other dragons would slip out to the south and make a wider circle out to sea.
"Though it won't do for long," Granby said, "and then we will have all of them to deal with, and Lien too. Temerer can't fight her with 300 men hanging off his sides."
"An attack such as this will rouse up all the camp, and someone will see us going by, sooner or late," Kalkreuth agreed. "Still, it will gain us more time than if the alarm were raised at once. I would rather save half the corps than none."
"But if we must circle about so far out of the way, it will take a good deal more time, and we will never get so many away," Temerer objected. "Perhaps if we only went and killed him very quickly and quietly, we might then get away before they know what we are about, or at least thumped him hard enough he could not pay any more attention."
"What we truly need," Lawrence said abruptly, "is only to put him quietly out of the way. What about drugging him?"
In the thoughtful pause, he added,
"They have been feeding the dragon's livestock dosed with opium all through the campaign. If we slip him one more thoroughly saturated, likely he will not notice any queer taste, at least not until it is too late."
"His captain will hardly let him eat a cow if it's still wandering in circles," Granby said.
"If the soldiers are eating boiled grass, the dragons cannot be eating as much as they like either," Lawrence said. "I suspect he will prefer to ask forgiveness than permission if a cow goes by him in the night."
Tharkey undertook to manage it.
"Find me some nankeen trousers and a loose shirt, and give me a dinner basket to carry," he said.
"I assure you I will be able to walk through the camp quite openly. If anyone stops me, I will speak pigeon to them and repeat the name of some senior officer. And if you give me a few bottles of drugged brandy for them to take from me, so much the better. No reason we cannot let the watch dose themselves with laudanum, too."
"But will you be able to get back?" Granby asked.
"I do not mean to try," Tharkey said. "After all, our purpose is to get out. I can certainly walk to the harbour long before you will have finished loading, and find a fisherman to bring me out. They are surely doing a brisk business with those ships."
Kalkreuth's aides were crawling around the courtyard on hands and knees, drawing out a map in chalks, large enough for the feral dragons to make out, and, by serendipity, colourful and interesting enough to command their attention. The bright blue stripe of the river would be their guide. It passed through the city walls and then curved down to the harbour, passing through the French camp as it went.
"We will go single file, keeping over the water," Lawrence said, "and pray be sure the other dragons understand," he added anxiously to Temerer. "They must go very quietly, as if they were trying to creep up on some wary herd of animals."
"I will tell them again,"
Temerer promised, and sighed a very little.
"It is not that I am not happy to have them here," he confided quietly, "and really they have been minding me quite well, when one considers that they have never been taught. But it would have been so very nice to have Maximus and Lily here, and perhaps Exidium. He would know just what to do, I am sure."
"I cannot quarrel with you," Lawrence said. "Apart from all considerations of management, Maximus alone could likely have taken 600 men or more, being a particularly large regal copper." He paused and asked tentatively, "Will you tell me now what else has been worrying you? Are you afraid they will lose their heads in the moment?"
"Oh, no, it is not that,"
Temere said, and looked down, prodding a little at the remains of his dinner.
"We are running away, are we not?" he said abruptly.
"I would be sorry to call it so," Lawrence said, surprised. He had thought Temere wholly satisfied with their plan. Now that they meant to carry out the Prussian garrison with them, and for his own part thought it a manoeuvre to applaud if they could manage it.
"There is no shame in retreating to preserve one's strength for a future battle, with better hope of victory."
"What I mean is, if we are going away, then Napoleon really has won," Temere said, "and England will be at war for a long time still, because he means to conquer us. So we cannot ask the government to change anything for dragons. We must only do as we are told until he is beaten." He hunched his shoulders a little and added, "I do understand it, Lawrence, and I promise I will do my duty and not always be complaining. I am only sorry."
It was with some awkwardness in the face of this handsome speech that Lawrence recognized, and had then to convey to Temere, the change in his own sentiments, an awkwardness increased by the bewildered Temere's dragging out one after another all of Lawrence's own earlier protests on the subject.
"I have not, I hope, changed in essentials," Lawrence said, struggling for justification in his own eyes as well as his dragon's, "but only in my understanding. Napoleon has made manifest, for all the world to see, the marked advantages to a modern army of closer cooperation between men and dragons. We return to England not only to take up our post again, but bearing this vital intelligence, which makes it not merely our desire, but our duty to promote such change in England."
Temere required very little additional persuasion, and all Lawrence's embarrassment at seeming to be fickle was mitigated by his dragon's jubilant reaction, and the immediate necessity of presenting him with many cautions. Every earlier objection remained, of course, and Lawrence knew very well they would face the most violent opposition.
"I do not care if anyone else minds," Temere said, "or if it takes a long time. Lawrence, I am so very happy. I only wish we were at home already."
All that night and the next day they continued to labour over the harnesses. The cavalry horse's tack was soon seized upon and cannibalized, and the tanner's shops raided. Dusk was falling, and Fellows were still frantically climbing with his men all over the dragons, sewing on more carrying loops of anything which was left—leather, rope, braided silk—until they seemed to be festooned with ribbons and bows and flounces.
"It is as good as court dress," Ferris said, to much muffled hilarity,
as a ration of spirits was passed around.
"We ought to fly straight to London and present them to the Queen."
The Fleur de Nuit took up his appointed position at the usual hour, settling back on his haunches for the night's duty. As the night deepened, the edges of his midnight blue hide slowly faded into the general darkness, until all that could be seen of him were his enormous dinner-plate eyes, milky white, and illuminated by the reflections of the campfires. Occasionally he stirred, or turned round to have a look towards the ocean, and the eyes would vanish for a moment, but they always came back again. Tharkay had slipped out a few hours before. They watched, anxiously. For an eternity, counting by the heartbeat, for two turns, counting by the glass. The dragons were all ranged in lines, the first men aboard and ready to go at once.
"If nothing comes of it," Lawrence said softly,
but then the palely gleaming eyes blinked once, twice, then for a little longer, then again, and then with the lids drooping gradually to cover them, they drifted slowly and languorously to the ground, and the last narrow slits winked out of sight.
"Mark time,"
Lawrence called down to the aides-de-camp, standing anxiously below, holding their hourglasses ready. Then Temeraire leapt away, straining a little under the weight. Lawrence found it queer to be conscious of so many men aboard, so many strangers crowding near him, the communal nervous quickening of their breath like a rasp, the muffled curses and low cries silenced at once by their neighbours, their bodies and their warmth muting the biting force of the wind. Temeraire followed the river out through the city walls, staying over the water so that the living sound of the current running down to the sea should mask the sound of his wings. Boats drawn up along the sides of the river creaked their ropes, murmuring, and the great brooding bulk of the harbour crane protruded vulture-like over the water. The river was smooth and black beneath them, spangled a little with reflections, the fires of the French camp throwing small yellow flickers onto the low swells. To their either side, The French encampment lay sprawling over the banks of the river, lanterned limbs showing here and there the slope of a dragon's body, the fold of a wing, the pitted blue iron of a cannon barrel. Lumps that were soldiers lay sleeping in their rough bivouacs, huddled near one another under blankets of coarse wool, overcoats, or only mats of straw, with their feet poking out towards the fires. If there were any sounds to be heard from the camp, however, Lawrence did not know it. His heart was beating too loudly in his ears as they went gliding by, Temeraire's wing beats almost languidly slow. And then they were breathing again as the fires and lights fell behind them. They had come safely past the edges of the encampment, with 1 mile of soft, marshy ground to the sea, the sound of the surf rising ahead. Temeraire put on eager speed, and the wind began to whistle past the edges of his wings. Somewhere, hanging off the rigging below, Lawrence heard a man vomiting. They were already over the ocean. The ship lanterns beckoned them on, almost glaring bright with no moon for competition. As they drew near, Lawrence could see a candelabrum standing in the stern windows of one of the ships, a 74, illuminating the golden letters upon her stern. She was the Vanguard, and Lawrence leaned forward and pointed Temeraire towards her. Young Turner crept out onto Temeraire's shoulder and held up the night signal lantern where it could be seen, showing the friendly signal out its front, one long blue light, two short red, with thin squares of cloth laid over the lantern hole to make the colours, and then the three short white lights to request a silent response, and again, as they drew nearer and nearer. There was a delay. Had the lookout not seen? Was the signal too old? Lawrence had not seen a new signal book in almost a year. But then the quick blue-red of the answer shone back at them, and there were more lights coming out on deck as they descended.
"Ahoy the ship!" Lawrence called, cupping his hands around his mouth. "Ahoy the wing!" came the baffled reply from the officer of the watch, faint and hard to hear. "And who the devil are you?"
Temeraire hovered carefully overhead. They flung down long, knotted ropes, the ends thumping hollowly upon the deck of the ship, and the men began to struggle loose from the harness with excessive haste to be off.
"Temeraire, tell them to go carefully there," Lawrence said sharply. "The harness won't stand hard use, and their fellows will be next aboard."
Temeraire rumbled at them, low in German, and the descent calmed a little still further when one man, missing his grasp, slipped and went tumbling down with a too loud cry that broke only with the wet, melon-thump sound of his head striking against the deck. Afterwards the others went more warily, and below their officers began to force them back against the ship's rails and out of the way, using hands and sticks to push them into place instead of shouted orders.
"Is everyone down?" Temeraire asked Lawrence.
Only a handful of the crew were left up on his back, and at Lawrence's nod Temeraire carefully let himself down and slipped into the water beside the ship, scarcely throwing up a splash. There was a great deal of noise beginning to rise from the deck, the sailors and soldiers talking at one another urgently and uselessly in their different tongues, and the officers having difficulty reaching one another through the crowd of men. The crew were showing lanterns wildly in every direction.
"Hush!" Temeraire said to them all sharply, putting his head over the side. "And put away those lights! Can you not see we are trying to keep quiet? And if any of you do not listen to me or begin to scream like great children just because I'm a dragon, I will pick you up and throw you overboard, see if I do not," he added.
"Where is the captain?"
Lawrence called up, into a perfect silence, Temeraire's threat having been taken most seriously.
"Will? Is that Will Lawrence?"
A man in a nightshirt and cap leaned over the side, staring.
"The devil, man! Did you miss the sea so much you had to turn your dragon into a ship? What is his rating?"
"Jerry,"
Lawrence said, grinning, "you will do me the kindness to send out every last boat you have to carry the message to the other ships. We are bringing out the garrison, and we must get them embarked by morning, or the French will make the country too hot to hold us."
"What? The whole garrison?" Captain Stewart said. "How many of them are there?"
15,000, more or less," Lawrence said. "Never mind," he added, as Stewart began to splutter. "You must pack them in somehow, and at least get them over to Sweden. They are damned brave fellows, and we aren't leaving them behind. I must get back to ferrying. God only knows how long we have until they notice us."
Going back to the city, they passed over Arcady, coming with his own load. The feral leader was nipping at the tails of a couple of the younger members of his flock, keeping them from meandering off the course. He waved his tail-tip at Temeraire as they shot by, Temeraire stretched out full length and going as fast as he might, as quiet as he might. The courtyard was in controlled havoc, the battalions marching out one after another in parade ground order to their assigned dragons, boarding them with as little noise as could be managed. They had marked each dragon's place with paint on the flagstones, already scratched and trampled by claws and boots. Temeraire dropped into his large corner, and the sergeants and officers began herding the men quickly along. Each climbed up the side and thrust his head and shoulders through the highest open loop, getting a grip on the harness with his hands or clinging to the man above, trying for footholds on the harness. Winston, one of the harness men, flew over gasping,
"Anything that needs fixing, sir?"
and ran off instantly on hearing a negative to the next dragon. Fellows and his handful of other men were dashing about with similar urgency, repairing loose or broken bits of harness. Temeraire was ready again.
"Mark time," Lawrence called.
"An hour and a quarter, sir,"
came back Dyer's treble, worse than Lawrence had hoped, and many of the other dragons were only getting away with their second loads alongside them.
"We will get faster as we go along," Temeraire said stoutly,
and Lawrence answered,
"Yes, quickly as we can now,"
and they were airborne again. Farke found them again as they dropped their second load of men down to one of the transports in the harbour. He had somehow gotten on deck, and now he came swarming hand over hand up the knotted ropes, in the opposite direction from the descending soldiers. "The Fleur de Nuit took the sheep, but he did not eat the whole thing," he said quietly, when he had gotten up to Lawrence's side. "He ate only half and hid the rest. I do not know it will keep him asleep all night." Lawrence nodded. There was nothing to be done for it. They had only to keep going as long as they could. A suggestion of colour was showing in the east now, and too many men still crowded the lanes of the city, waiting to get aboard. Arcady was showing himself not useless in a time of crisis. He chivered along his ferrules to go quicker, and himself had already managed 8 circuits. He came sailing in for his next load, even as Temeraire finally lifted away with his 7th. His larger loads took more time to get aboard and disembark. The other ferrules, too, were holding up bravely. The little motley-coloured one whom Keynes had patched up after the avalanche was showing himself particularly devoted, and ferrying his tiny loads of 20 men with great determination and speed. There were 10 dragons on the decks of the ships unloading as Temeraire landed, mostly the larger of the ferrules. The next pass would see the city close to empty, Lawrence thought, and looked at the sun. It would be a close-run race. And then, abruptly, from the French covert rose a small, smoking blue light. Lawrence looked in horror as the flare burst over the river. The 3 dragons, who were in transit at the moment, squawked in alarm, jerking from the sudden flash of light, and a couple of men fell from their carrying harnesses, screaming to plunge into the river.
"Jump off! Jump, damn you!"
Lawrence bellowed at the men still climbing down from Temeraire's harness.
"Temeraire!"
Temeraire called it out in German, almost unnecessarily. The men were leaping free from all the dragons, many falling into the water, where the ship's crews began frantically to fish them out. A handful were stuck still on the carrying harnesses, or clinging to the ropes. But Temeraire waited no longer. The other dragons came leaping into the air behind him, and as a pack they stormed back to the city, past the shouts and now blazing lanterns of the French encampment.
"Ground crew aboard!"
Lawrence shouted through his speaking trumpet, as Temeraire came down into the courtyard for the last time, and outside the French guns sounded their first tentative coughing roars. Pratt came running with the last dragon egg in his arms, wrapped and bundled around with padding and oilskin, to be thrust into Temeraire's belly rigging, and Fellows and his men abandoned their makeshift harness repairs. All the ground crew came swarming aboard with the ease of long practice on the ropes, getting quickly latched to the harness proper.
"All accounted for, sir!"
Ferris yelled from farther along Temeraire's back. He had to use his speaking trumpet to be audible. Above their heads, the artillery was sounding from the walls, the shorter, hollow coughs of howitzers, the whistling whine and fall of mortar shells. In the courtyard, shouting now, Kalkreuth and his aides were directing the last battalions aboard. Temeraire picked Iskierka up in his mouth and slung her around onto his shoulders. She yawned and picked up her head drowsily.
"Where's my captain? Oh, are we fighting now?"
Her eyes opened all the way at the rolling thunder of the guns going off one after another over their heads.
"Here I am! Don't fret!"
Granby called, clambering up the rest of the way to catch her by the harness, just in time to keep her from leaping off again.
"General!"
Lawrence shouted. Kalkreuth waved them on, refusing, but his aides snatched him bodily and heaved him up. The men let go their own grips on the harness to take hold of him and hand him up along until he was deposited next to Lawrence, breathing hard and with his thin hair disarrayed. His wig had vanished in the ascent. The drummer was beating the final retreat. Men were running down from the walls, abandoning the guns, some even leaping from the turrets and ledges straight onto the dragon's backs, grabbing blindly for some purchase. The sun was coming up over the eastern ramparts, the night breaking up into long, narrow, ranked clouds like rolled cigars, blue and touched all along their sides with orange fire. There was no more time.
"Go aloft!"
Lawrence shouted, and Temeray gave a shattering roar and leapt away with a great thrust of his hind quarters, men dangling from his harness. Some slipped away, grasping vainly at the air, and fell down to the stones of the courtyard below, crying out. All the dragons came rising into the air behind him, roaring with many voices, with many wings. The French dragons were coming out of their covert and going to the pursuit, their crews still scrambling to get into battle order. Abruptly, Temeraire slowed to let the ferals pass him, and then he put his head around and said,
"There, now you may breathe fire at them."
And with a squeak of delight, Iskierka whipped her head around and let loose a great torrent of flame over Temeraire's back and into their pursuers' faces, sending them recoiling back.
"Go now, quickly!"
Lawrence was shouting. They had won a little space, but Lien was coming, rising from the French camp, bellowing orders. The French dragons, milling about in their riders' confusion, fell instantly in line with her. There was no sign of her earlier self-restraint. Seeing them now on the verge of escape, she was beating after them with furious speed, outdistancing all the French dragons but the littlest couriers, who desperately fought to keep pace with her. Temeraire stretched long and went flat out, legs gathered close, rough plastered against his neck, wings scooping the air like oars. They devoured the miles of ground as Lien did the distance between them, the thunder coughing of the long guns of the warships beckoning them to the safety of their sheltering broadside. The first acrid wisps were in their faces. Lien was stretching out her talons, not yet in reach, and the little couriers were making wild attempts on their sides, snatching away a few men in their talons. Iskierka was gleefully firing off at them in answer. Abruptly they were blind, plunging into a thick, black powder cloud. Lawrence's eyes were streaming as they came out again, clear and away past the encampment and still going fast. The city and its fading lights was dwindling behind them with every wing stroke. They shot out low over the harbour, the last of the men being hauled up out of the water and into the transports. And here came the great rolling drumbeat of the cannon, canister shot whistling by thick as hailstones behind them to halt the French dragons. Lien burst through the cloud and tried to come after them, even through the rain of hot iron, but the little French couriers shrilled, protesting. Some threw themselves on her back, clinging, to try and drag her out of range. She shook them all off with a great heave and would have pressed on, but one more, crying out, flung himself before her with desperate courage. His hot black blood was flung spattering upon her breast as the shot which would have struck her tore instead through his shoulder, and she halted at last, her battle fury broken, to catch him up when he would have fallen from the sky. She withdrew then with the rest of her anxious escort of couriers, but hovering out of range over the snow-driven shore, she voiced one final longing and savage cry of disappointment, as loud as if she might crack the sky. It chased Temeraire out of the harbour and beyond, leaving a ghost of itself still ringing in their ears, but the sky ahead was opening up to a fierce, deep, cloudless blue, an endless road of wind and water before them. A signal was flying from the mast of the Vanguard.
"Fair wind, sir," Turner said as they passed the ships by.
Lawrence leaned into the cold sea wind, bright and biting. It scrubbed into the hollows of Temeraire's sides to clean away the last of the pooled eddies of smoke, spilling away in grey trailers behind them. Riggs had given the riflemen the order to hold their fire, and Dunn and Hackley were already calling habitual insults to each other as they sponged out their barrels and put their powder horns away. It would be a long road still, as much as a week's flying, with this contrary wind in their faces and so many smaller dragons to keep in company. But to Lawrence it seemed he already beheld the rough stone coast of Scotland, heather gone brown and purplish sere, and the mountains mottled with white, past the green hills. A great hunger filled him for those hills, those mountains, thrusting up sharp and imperious,
the broad yellowing squares of harvested farmland, and the sheep grown fat and woolly for winter, the thickets of pine and ash in the coverts standing close around Temeraire's clearing. Out ahead of them, Arkady began something very like a marching song, chanting lines answered by the other ferals, their voices ringing out across the sky, each to each. Temeraire added his own to the chorus, and little Iskiaka began to scrabble at his neck, demanding, "What are they saying? What does it mean?"
"We are flying home," Temeraire said, translating. "We are all flying home."
Extracts from a letter, published in the Philosophical Transactions of the Royal Society, April 1806. March 3rd, 1806. Gentlemen of the Royal Society, it is with trepidation that I take up my pen to address this august body regarding Sir Edward Howe's recent discourse upon the subject of draconic aptitude for mathematics. For an amateur of so little distinction as myself to make reply to so illustrious an authority must smack of vainglory, and I tremble at the notion of offering offence to that gentleman or his many and justly deserved supporters. Only the sincerest belief in the merits of my case, and, beyond this, a grave concern for the deeply flawed course upon which the study of dragons seems bent, would suffice to overcome the natural scruple I must feel at setting myself in opposition to the judgment of one whose experience so greatly outstrips my own, and to whom I would show unhesitating deference, if not for evidence I must consider irrefutable, which, after much anxiety, I herein submit to the consideration of this body. My qualifications for this work are by no means substantial, my time for the pursuit of natural history being sadly curtailed by the demands of my parish, so if I am to persuade, it must be with the force of my argument alone, and not through influence or impressive references. By no means do I intend any disparagement of those noble creatures under discussion, nor to quarrel with any man who would call them admirable. Their virtues are manifest, and among the highest of these the essential good humour of their nature, evident in their submitting to the guidance of mankind for the sake of affection, rather than through a compulsion it were quite impossible for any man to bring to bear upon them. In this they have shown themselves very like that more familiar and most amiable creature, the dog, who will shun the company of his own kind, and cleave in preference unto his master, thus displaying almost alone amongst the beasts a discrimination for the society of his betters. This same discrimination dragons show, greatly to their credit, and certainly no one can deny that with it is matched an understanding superior to virtually all the animal world, that renders them arguably the most valuable and useful of all our domestic beasts. And yet it has been some years now since many eminent gentlemen, unsatisfied with these considerable encomiums, have begun to put before the world cautiously and in measured stages a body of work which in its sum total, almost as if by joint intention, leads the thinking man to the inevitable and seductive conclusion that dragons rise beyond the animal sphere entirely, that they possess in full measure equal to man the faculty of reason and intellect. The implications of such an idea I scarcely need enumerate. The foremost argument of these scholars to date has been that dragons alone among the beasts possess language, and show in their speech to the observer all the attributes of feeling and free will. Yet this argument I cannot allow even to be persuasive, much the less conclusive. The parrot, too, has mastered all the tongues of men. Dogs and horses may be trained to comprehend some scattered words. If the latter possess the facile throats of the former, would they not speak to us also and solicit of us greater attentions? And as for these other arguments, who that has heard a dog whine, left behind by his master, would deny that animals know affection? And who that has set a horse at a fence and had it refused would deny that beasts possess their own, and often lamentably contrary, will? Apart from these examples drawn from the animal kingdom, we have further seen in the famous work of Baron von Kempelen and Monsieur de Vaucanson that the most astonishing automata may be produced from a little tin and copper, which may produce speech through the operation of a few levers, or even mimic intelligent motion and persuade the uninformed observer of a lifelike animation, though they are nothing but clockwork and gears. Let us not mistake these simulacra of intelligence in brutish or mechanical behaviour for true reason,
the province only of man.
Once we have set these aside as insufficient proofs of draconic intelligence, we come to Sir Edward Howe's most recent essay, which puts forth an argument not so easily dismissed. The ability of dragons to perform advanced mathematical calculations, an achievement which eludes many an otherwise educated man, and is not to be found anywhere in the animal world, nor imitated by machinery. However, upon closer examination, we discover that these feats we are to accept upon the scantiest of evidence, the testimony of the dragon's captain and his officers, his fond and affectionate companions. Affirmed by Sir Edward Howe, only through one examination made personally over the course of a few hours. This may seem sufficient to some number of my readers, the essay made more plausible by its less ambitious forerunners in the field. However, permit me to point out that a similarly fragile body of evidence serves as the foundation of many of these earlier works as well. My audience may justly demand to know why such a claim might be pressed, intentionally or no. Without making any accusation, I will, for the satisfaction of this demand, speculate not upon the actual, but upon plausible motives, though only considering those which may be called disinterested. I trust that these are sufficient to allay any suspicion that I mean to suggest any sordid conspiracy, for nothing could be further from my mind. It is natural that the huntsman should love his hounds, and see in their brute devotions a human affection, that he should read into the tenor of their barks and the gleam of their eyes a deeper communication. It is the huntsman's own sensitivity which makes truth of this illusion, and makes him all the better a custodian of his flock. That the officers of the aerial corps have a communication of this sort with their dragons, I do not doubt. But this must be laid to the credit of the men, and not the beasts, even if the men deny the credit of it in all sincerity. Furthermore, all those who have affection for these noble creatures must desire the improvement of their condition, and an acknowledgment of, as it were, the humanity of these beasts must surely oblige us to deal with them more kindly than heretofore, which cannot be called anything but a generous motive. So far, I have only endeavoured to cast doubt upon the work of others. If positive evidence to the contrary be desired, however, we need only to contemplate the condition of feral dragons to have this truth at once illustrated before us. I have spoken at length with those good herdsmen who tend the breeding grounds at Penivan, whose work daily brings them into the circles of the wild dragons, and who, rough as they themselves are, view these beasts with an unromantic disposition. Left to their own devices, unharnessed and free, these feral dragons display native cunning and an animal intelligence, but no more. They make no use of language save the grunting and hissing common among animals. They form no society nor civilized relations. They have no art and no industry. They manufacture nothing, neither shelter nor tools. The same cannot be said of the meanest savage in the most barren part of the earth. What dragons know of higher things they have learned only from men, and the impulse is not native to the species. Surely this is sufficient evidence of distinction between man and dragon, if such evidence be necessary. If with these arguments I have failed to convince, I will close with a final assertion that a conclusion so extravagant, flying in the face of all recorded and scriptural authority, and much observation to the contrary, must rather be proven true than false, and if even eligible for consideration, ought to endure challenge greater than what my own small powers have enabled me to offer herein, with however good a will upon my part, and requires a far more substantial body of evidence, obtained and affirmed by impartial observers. It is in hopes of provoking wiser men than myself to doubt and to fresh investigations that I have ventured to make this attempt at refutation, and I most sincerely beg pardon of any man whom I may have herein offended, whether through my opinions or my lack of skill in expounding upon them. Pray permit me to style myself with the highest respect your most humble, obedient servant, D. Salcombe, Brecon, Wales. This is Simon Vance. We hope you've enjoyed this production of Black Powder War by Naomi Novik, published by arrangement with Random House Audio Publishing Group, a division of Random House, Inc. Text copyright 2006, by Naomi Novik. Production copyright 2007. Books on tape.